This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1. Domes of Fire. The Tomilly. Book 1. By David Eddings. Copyright 1992 by David Eddings. All rights reserved. Narrated by Eric Sandvold. This book contains 484 pages on 12 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player and fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Annotation. Continues the story of the Kingdom of Alenia, begun in the Alenium Trilogy. The Diamond Throne, RC 30180. The Ruby Knight, RC 32298. And The Sapphire Rose, RC 34210. 6 years ago, Sparhawk defeated the evil god Azash. Now rumors of the return of the troll gods, who threaten the Tomul Empire, send Sparhawk, with family and followers, to save the Empire. Bestseller, 1992. From the book jacket. 6 years had passed since the redoubtable knight Sparhawk had triumphed over the evil god Azash and returned to Alenia with Queen Aelana, his bride. And now a new danger had arisen to threaten the peace of Aelana's realm. The trouble had started quietly. At home, bandits began to plague the hill country. In neighboring Lamorcand, the customary political unrest turned ominous with whispers that the bloody heroes of old soon would rise again, and travelers reported that the trolls had all disappeared from the icy northern haunts of Thalesia. Simple problems, apparently unrelated, until an ambassador arrived from the far-off Tomul Empire, begging Sparhawk's aid. For these same dangers that stalked Aelana's kingdom had already struck his realm full force. The fabled ancient warriors of Tomilly had indeed returned, intent on carnage. Monsters and fell magics had followed, and the havoc and terror they spawned were tearing the empire apart. The emperor had sent for the Pandion knight, who had killed the god Azash. If Sparhawk wanted to stop this danger before it could savage his own land, he now must lend his aid. Sparhawk, Aelana, and their daughter, Princess Danae, agreed to make the grueling trek to the far-distant empire of the east. They traveled in company with a handful of trusted companions, the stalwart champions of the 4 militant orders, the knight Barret, Mirtai the giantess, and the young thief Talon. With the child goddess Afriel to speed their journey, they began the treacherous traverse of the utmost reaches of the Darisian continent to Tomilly's distant capital. There, in the emperor's glittering court, they would encounter corruption, treachery, and a greater danger than any man had faced before. David Eddings opens a bold new chapter in the saga begun in his best-selling series, The Alenium. In his dazzling trademark style, Eddings weaves a compelling tale of strange magic and breathtaking adventure, staunch friends and deadly enemies. Domes of Fire is a triumph of sheer storytelling magic from fantasy's premier genius. About the author. David Eddings was born in Spokane, Washington, in 1931, and was raised in the Puget Sound area north of Seattle. He received a Bachelor of Arts degree from Reed College in Portland, Oregon, in 1954, and a Master of Arts degree from the University of Washington in 1961. He has served in the United States Army, worked as a buyer for the Boeing Company, has been a grocery clerk, and has taught college English. He has lived in many parts of the United States. His first novel, High Hunt, published by Putnam in 1973, was a contemporary adventure story. The field of fantasy has always been of interest to him, however, and he turned to the Belgariad in an effort to develop certain technical and philosophical ideas concerning the genre. Eddings and his wife Lee currently reside in the Southwest. Other books by David Eddings. The Belgariad. Book 1, Pawn of Prophecy. Book 2, Queen of Sorcery. Book 3, Magician's Gambit. Book 4, Castle of Wizardry. Book 5, Enchanter's Endgame. The Malorian, Book 1, Guardians of the West, Book 2, King of the Murgos, Book 3, Demon Lord of Karanda, Book 4, Sorceress of Darshiva, Book 5, The Seeress of Kel. The Elenium, Book 1, The Diamond Throne, Book 2, The Ruby Knight, Book 3, The Sapphire Rose. The Losers. Domes of Fire, Book 1 of the Tomali. For Veronica, for her health, and for Maria, for her enthusiasm. Two very special ladies in our lives. Narrator's note: captions to maps found in the print edition are not included in this recording. End of narrator's note. Prologue. Excerpted from Chapter 2 of The Sirga Affair, An Examination of the Recent Crisis, compiled by the Contemporary History Department of the University of Mathurian. It was quite obvious to the Imperial Council at this point that the Empire was facing a threat of the gravest nature, a threat that His Imperial Majesty's government was ill-prepared to confront. The Empire had long relied upon the armies of Aton to defend her interests during the periodic outbreaks of incidental civic disorder that are normal and to be expected in a disparate population ruled by a strong central authority. The situation facing His Majesty's government this time, however, did not appear to arise from spontaneous demonstrations by a few malcontented hotheads spilling out into the streets from various university campuses during the traditional recess that follows final examinations. Those particular demonstrations can be taken in stride, and order is usually restored with a minimum of bloodshed. The government soon realized that this time, however, things were different. The demonstrators were not high-spirited schoolboys, for one thing, and domestic tranquility did not return when classes at the universities resumed. The authorities might still have maintained order had the various disruptions been the result of ordinary revolutionary fervor. The mere presence of Aton warriors can dampen the spirits of even the most enthusiastic under normal circumstances. This time, the customary acts of vandalism accompanying the demonstrations were quite obviously of paranormal origin. Inevitably, the Imperial government cast a questioning eye at the Styrix in Sarsos. An investigation by Styrix members of the Imperial Council, whose loyalty to the throne could not be questioned, however, quite clearly indicated that Styricum had had no part in the disturbances. The paranormal incidents were obviously coming from some as-yet-to-be-determined sources, and were so widespread that they could not have emanated from the activities of a few Styrix renegades. The Styrix themselves were unable to identify the source of this activity, and even the legendary Zelasta, preeminent magician in all of Styricum though he might be, ruefully confessed to total bafflement. It was Zelasta, however, who suggested the course ultimately taken by His Majesty's government. He advised that the Empire might seek assistance from the Eosian continent, and he specifically directed the government's attention to a man named Sparhawk. All Imperial representatives on the Eosian continent were immediately commanded to drop everything else and to concentrate their full attention upon this man. It was imperative that His Majesty's government have information about this Sparhawk person. As the reports from Eosia began to filter in, the Imperial Council began to develop a composite picture of Sparhawk, his appearance, his personality, and his history. Sir Sparhawk, they discovered, was a member of one of the quasi-religious orders of the Aline Church. His particular order is referred to as the Pandion Knights. He is a tall, lean man of early middle years, with a battered face, a keen intelligence, and an abrupt, even abrasive manner. The Knights of the Aline Church are fearsome warriors, and Sir Sparhawk is in the forefront of their ranks of champions. At the time in the history of the Eosian continent, when the four orders of the Church Knights were founded, the circumstances were so desperate that the Alenes set aside their customary prejudices and permitted the militant orders to receive instruction in the arcane practices of Styricum. and it was the proficiency of the church knights in those arts that helped them to prevail during the first Zemach War some 5 centuries ago. Sir Sparhawk held a position for which there is no equivalent in our empire. He was the hereditary champion of the royal house of the kingdom of Alenia. Western Alenes have a chivalric culture replete with many archaisms. The challenge, essentially an offer to engage in single combat, is the customary response of members of the nobility who feel that their honor has been somehow sullied. It is amazing to note that not even ruling monarchs are exempt from the necessity of answering these challenges. In order to avoid the inconvenience of responding to the impertinences of assorted hotheads, the monarchs of Eosia customarily designate some highly skilled, and usually widely feared, warrior as a surrogate. Sir Sparhawk's nature and reputation are such that even the most quarrelsome nobles of the kingdom of Alenia find, after careful consideration, that they have not really been insulted. It is a credit to Sir Sparhawk's skill and cool judgment that he has seldom even been obliged to kill anyone during these affairs, since, by ancient custom, a severely incapacitated combatant may save his life by surrendering and withdrawing his challenge. After his father's death, Sir Sparhawk presented himself to King Aldrius, the father of the present queen, to take up his duties. King Aldrius, however, was a weak monarch, and he was dominated by his sister Arissa and by Anias, the primate of Simura, who was also Princess Arissa's surreptitious lover, and the father of her bastard son Lycaeus. The primate of Simura, who was the de facto ruler of Alenia, had hopes of ascending the throne of the archprelacy of the Alene Church in the holy city of Kyrellos, and the presence of the stern and moralistic church knight at the court inconvenienced him. And so it was that he persuaded King Aldrius to send Sir Sparhawk into exile in the kingdom of Rendor. In time, King Aldrius also became inconvenient, and Primate Anias and the princess poisoned him, thus elevating Princess Elana, Aldrius' daughter, to the throne. Though she was young, Queen Elana had received some training from Sir Sparhawk as a child, and she was a far stronger monarch than her father had been. She soon became more than a mere inconvenience to the primate. He poisoned her as well. But Sir Sparhawk's fellow Pandions, aided by their tutor in the arcane arts, a steric woman named Sophrenia, cast an enchantment that sealed the queen up in crystal and sustained her life. Thus it stood when Sir Sparhawk returned from exile. Since the militant orders had no wish to see the primate of Simura on the archprelate's throne, certain of the champions of the other three orders were sent to assist Sir Sparhawk in finding an antidote or a cure that could restore Queen Elana to health. Since the queen had denied Anias access to her treasury in the past, the church knights reasoned that should she be restored, she would once again deny Anias the funds he needed to pursue his candidacy. Anias allied himself with a renegade Pandion named Martell, and this Martell person was, like all Pandions, skilled in the use of steric magic. He cast obstacles, both physical and supernatural, in Sparhawk's path, but Sir Sparhawk and his companions were ultimately successful in discovering that Queen Elana could only be restored by a magical object known as the Bellium. Western Alenes are a peculiar people. They have a level of sophistication in worldly matters that sometimes surpasses our own, but at the same time, they have an almost childlike belief in the more lurid forms of magic. This Bellium, we are told, is a very large sapphire that was laboriously carved into the shape of a rose at some time in the distant past. The Alenes here insist that the artisan who carved it was a troll. We will not dwell on that absurdity. At any rate, Sir Sparhawk and his friends overcame many obstacles and were ultimately able to obtain the peculiar talisman, and, they claim, it was successful in restoring Queen Elana, although one strongly suspects that their tutor, Sophrenia, accomplished the task unaided, and that the apparent use of the Bellium was little more than a subterfuge she used to protect her from the virulent bigotry of Western Alenes. When Archprelate Cluvonus died, the hierocracy of the Hellene Church journeyed to Kyrellos to participate in the election of his successor. Election is a peculiar practice that involves the stating of preference. That candidate who receives the approval of a majority of his fellows is elevated to the office in question. This, of course, is an unnatural procedure, but since the Hellene clergy is ostensibly celibate, there is no non-scandalous way the archprelacy can be made hereditary. The primate of Simura had bribed a goodly number of high churchmen to state a preference for him during the deliberations of the hierocracy, but he still fell short of the needed majority. It was at this point that his underling, the aforementioned Martel, led an assault on the holy city, hoping thereby to stampede the hierocracy into electing primate Anias. Sir Sparhawk and a limited number of church knights were able to keep Martel away from the basilica where the hierocracy was deliberating. Most of the city of Kyrellos, however, was severely damaged or destroyed during the fighting. As the situation reached crisis proportions, help arrived for the beleaguered defenders in the form of the armies of the Western Hellene kingdoms. Hellene politics, one notes, are quite robust. The connection between the primate of Simura and the renegade Martel came to light, as well as the fact that the pair had a subterranean arrangement with Otha of Zemach. Outraged by the perfidy of the man, the hierocracy rejected his candidacy and elected instead one Dolmont, the patriarch of Demos. This Dolmont appears to be competent, though it may be too early to say for certain. Queen Aelana of the kingdom of Alenia was scarcely more than a child, but she appeared to be a strong-willed and spirited young woman. She had long had a secret preference for Sir Sparhawk, though he was more than 20 years her senior, and upon her recovery it had been announced that the two were betrothed. Following the election of Dolmont to the archprelacy, they were wed. Peculiarly enough, the queen retained her authority, although we must suspect that Sir Sparhawk exerts considerable influence upon her in state as well as domestic matters. The involvement of the Emperor of Zemach in the internal affairs of the Hellene Church was, of course, a casus belli, and the armies of Western Eosia, led by the Church Knights, marched eastward across Lamorkand to meet the Zemach hordes poised on the border. The long-dreaded Second Zemach War had begun. Sir Sparhawk and his companions, however, rode north to avoid the turmoil of the battlefield, and then turned eastward, crossed the mountains of northern Zemach, and surreptitiously made their way to Otha's capital at the city of Zemach, evidently in pursuit of Anias and Martel. The best efforts of the Empire's agents in the West have failed to reveal precisely what took place at Zemach. It is quite certain that Anias, Martel, and even Otha himself perished there. But they are of little note in the pageant of history. What is far more relevant is the incontrovertible fact that Azash, elder god of Styricum, and the driving force behind Otha and his Zemachs, also perished. And it is undeniably true that Sir Sparhawk was responsible. We must concede that the levels of magic unleashed at Zemach were beyond our comprehension, and that Sir Sparhawk has powers at his command such as no mortal has ever possessed. As evidence of the levels of violence unleashed in the confrontation, we need only point to the fact that the city of Zemach was utterly destroyed during the discussions. Clearly, Zelasta the Styric had been right. Sir Sparhawk, the prince consort of Queen Aelana, was the one man in all the world capable of dealing with the crisis in Tamale. Unfortunately, Sir Sparhawk was not a citizen of the Tamul Empire, and thus could not be summoned to the imperial capital at Methurian by the Emperor. His Majesty's government was in a quandary. The Emperor had no authority over this Sparhawk, and to have been obliged to appeal to a man who was essentially a private citizen would have been an unthinkable humiliation. The situation in the Empire was daily worsening, and our need for the intervention of Sir Sparhawk was growing more and more urgent. Of equal urgency was the absolute necessity of maintaining the Empire's dignity. It was ultimately the Foreign Office's most brilliant diplomat, First Secretary Oscania, who devised a solution to the dilemma. We will discuss His Excellency's brilliant diplomatic ploy at greater length in the following chapter. Part 1. Eyoja. Chapter 1. It was early spring, and the rain still had the lingering chill of winter. A soft, silvery drizzle sifted down out of the night sky and wreathed around the blocky watchtowers of Zamora, hissing in the torches on each side of the broad gate, and making the stones of the road leading up to the gate shiny and black. A lone rider approached the city. He was wrapped in a heavy traveler's cloak, and rode a tall, shaggy roan horse, with a long nose and flat, vicious eyes. The traveler was a big man, a bigness of large, heavy bone and ropey tendon, rather than of flesh. His hair was coarse and black, and at some time his nose had been broken. He rode easily, but with the peculiar alertness of the trained warrior. The big roan shuddered absently, shaking the rain out of his shaggy coat as they approached the east gate of the city, and stopped in the ruddy circle of torchlight just outside the wall. An unshaven gate guard in a rust-splotched breastplate and helmet, his patched green cloak hanging negligently from one shoulder, came out of the gatehouse to look inquiringly at the traveler. He was swaying slightly on his feet. "Just passing through, neighbor," the big man said in a quiet voice. He pushed back the hood of his cloak. "Oh," the guard said, "it's you, Prince Sparhawk. I didn't recognize you. Welcome home." "Thank you," Sparhawk replied. He could smell the cheap wine on the man's breath. "Would you like to have me send word to the palace that you've arrived, Your Highness?" "No, don't bother them. I can unsaddle my own horse."
"Aft. Ergit Loskatat, the good spirits are brimming over with jesting. Surprised for his Loskatat like this, possible."
"Liked, particularly lately disliked. Sparhawk private, spar, we private ceremony, liked ceremonies." He nudged his horse and rode on through the gate. The district near the city wall was poor, with shabby, run-down houses standing tightly packed beside each other, their second stories projecting out over the wet, littered streets. Sparhawk rode up a narrow, cobbled lane, with the slow clatter of the big roan's steel-shod hooves echoing back from the buildings. The night breeze had come up, and the crude signs identifying this or that tightly shuttered shop swung creaking on rusty hooks. A dog with nothing better to do came out of an alley to bark at them with brainless self-importance. Sparhawk's horse turned his head slightly to give the wet cur a long, level stare that spoke eloquently of death. The empty-headed dog's barking trailed off, and he cringed back, his rat-like tail between his legs. The horse bore down on him purposefully. The dog whined, then yelped, turned, and fled. Sparhawk's horse snorted derisively. "That makes you feel better, Farron?" Sparhawk asked the roan. Farron flicked his ears. "Shall we proceed, then?" A torch burned fitfully at an intersection, and a buxom young whore, in a cheap dress, stood wet and bedraggled in its ruddy, flaring light. Her dark hair was plastered to her head, the rouge on her cheeks was streaked, and she had a resigned expression on her face. "What are you doing out here in the rain, Owen?" Sparhawk asked her, reining in his horse. "I've been waiting for you, Sparhawk." Her tone was arch, and her dark eyes wicked. "Or for anyone else?" "Of course. I am a professional, Sparhawk, but I still owe you. Shouldn't we settle up one of these days?" He ignored that. "What are you doing working the streets?"
"Shonda and I had a fight," she shrugged. "I decided to go into business for myself."
"You're not vicious enough to be a street girl, Noeen."
He dipped his fingers into the pouch at his side, fished out several coins, and gave them to her. "Here," he instructed. "Get a room in an inn someplace, and stay off the streets for a few days. I'll talk with Platamy, and we'll see if we can make some arrangements for you." Her eyes narrowed.
"You don't have to do that, Sparhawk. I can take care of myself."
"Of course you can. That's why you're standing out here in the rain.
Just do it, Noeen. It's too late and too wet for arguments." This is two I owe you, Sparhawk. Are you absolutely sure?
She left it hanging.
Quite sure, little sister. I'm married now, remember?
So?
Never mind. Get in out of the weather.
Sparhawk rode on, shaking his head. He liked Naween, but she was hopelessly incapable of taking care of herself. He passed through a quiet square where all the shops and booths were shut down. There were few people abroad tonight, and few business opportunities. He let his mind drift back over the past month and a half. No one in Lamorkand had been willing to talk with him. Archprelate Dolmont was a wise man, learned in doctrine and church politics, but he was woefully ignorant of the way the common people thought. Sparhawk had patiently tried to explain to him that sending a church knight out to gather information was a waste of time, but Dolmont had insisted, and Sparhawk's oath obliged him to obey. And so it was that he had wasted 6 weeks in the ugly cities of southern Lamorkand, where no one had been willing to talk with him about anything more serious than the weather. To make matters even worse, Dolmont had quite obviously blamed the knight for his own blunder. In a dark side street, where the water dripped monotonously onto the cobblestones from the eaves of the houses, he felt Farron's muscles tense.
Sorry, he said quietly. I wasn't paying attention.
Someone was watching him, and he could clearly sense the animosity that had alerted his horse. Farron was a war horse. He could probably sense antagonism in his veins. Sparhawk muttered a quick spell in the Styric tongue, concealing the gestures that accompanied it beneath his cloak. He released the spell slowly to avoid alerting whoever was watching him. The watcher was not an Aline. Sparhawk sensed that immediately. He probed further. Then he frowned. There were more than one, and they were not Styrics either. He pulled his thought back, passively waiting for some clue as to their identity. The realization came as a chilling shock. The watchers were not human. He shifted slightly in his saddle, sliding his hand toward his sword hilt. Then the sense of the watchers was gone, and Farron shuddered with relief. He turned his ugly face to give his master a suspicious look.
"Don't ask me, Farron," Sparhawk told him. "I don't know either."
But that was not entirely true. The touch of the minds in the darkness had been vaguely familiar, and that familiarity had raised questions in Sparhawk's mind, questions he did not want to face. He paused at the palace gate long enough to firmly instruct the soldiers not to wake the whole house. Then he dismounted in the courtyard. A young man stepped out into the rain-swept yard from the stable.
"Why didn't you send word that you were coming, Sparhawk?"
he asked very quietly.
"Because I don't particularly like parades and wild celebrations in the middle of the night," Sparhawk told his squire, throwing back the hood of his cloak. "What are you doing up so late? I promised your mothers I'd make sure you got your rest. You're going to get me in trouble, Halad."
"Are you trying to be funny?"
Halad's voice was gruff, abrasive. He took Farron's reins.
"Come inside, Sparhawk. You'll rust if you stand out here in the rain."
"You're as bad as your father was.
It's an old family trait."
Halad led the prince consort and his evil-tempered warhorse into the hay-smelling stable, where a pair of lanterns gave off a golden light. Halad was a husky young man, with coarse black hair and a short-trimmed black beard. He wore tight-fitting black leather breeches, boots, and a sleeveless leather vest that left his arms and shoulders bare. A heavy dagger hung from his belt, and steel cuffs encircled his wrists. He looked and behaved so much like his father that Sparhawk felt again a pang of loss.
"I thought Talon would be coming back with you,"
Sparhawk's squire said as he began unsaddling Farron.
"He's got a cold. His mother, and yours, decided that he shouldn't go out in the weather, and I certainly wasn't going to argue with him."
"Wise decision," Halad said, absently slapping Farron on the nose as the big roan tried to bite him. "How are they?"
"Your mothers?" Fine. As Slady's still trying to fatten Elis up, but she's not having too much luck. How did you find out I was in town?
One of Platamy's cutthroats saw you coming through the gate. He sent word.
I suppose I should have known. You didn't wake my wife, did you?
Not with Mirtai standing watch outside her door, I didn't. Give me that wet cloak, my lord. I'll hang it in the kitchen to dry.
Sparhawk grunted and removed his sodden cloak.
The mail shirt, too, Sparhawk, Khalad added, before it rusts away entirely.
Sparhawk nodded, unbelted his sword, and began to struggle out of his chainmail shirt.
How's your training going?
Khalad made an indelicate sound.
I haven't learned anything I didn't already know. My father was a much better instructor than the ones at the chapter house. This idea of yours isn't going to work, Sparhawk. The other novices are all aristocrats, and when my brothers and I outstrip them on the practice field, they resent it. We make enemies every time we turn around.
He lifted the saddle from Farron's back and put it on the rail of a nearby stall. He briefly laid his hand on the big roan's back, then bent, picked up a handful of straw, and began to rub him down.
Wake some groom and have him do that, Sparhawk told him. Is anybody still awake in the kitchen?
The bakers are already up, I think.
Have one of them throw something together for me to eat. It's been a long time since lunch.
All right. What took you so long in Kyrellos?
I took a little side trip into Lamorkand. The civil war there is getting out of hand, and the archprelate wanted me to nose around a bit.
You should have gotten word to your wife. She was just about to send Mirtai out to find you.
Khalad grinned at him.
I think you're going to get yelled at again, Sparhawk.
There's nothing new about that. Is Kaltan here in the palace?
Khalad nodded.
The food's better here, and he isn't expected to pray 3 times a day. Besides, I think he's got his eye on one of the chambermaids.
That wouldn't surprise me very much. Is Stragan here, too?
No. Something came up, and he had to go back to Emsat.
Get Kaltan up, then. Have him join us in the kitchen. I want to talk with him. I'll be along in a bit. I'm going to the bathhouse first.
The water won't be warm. They let the fires go out at night.
We're soldiers of God, Khalad. We're all supposed to be unspeakably brave.
I'll try to remember that, my lord.
The water in the bathhouse was definitely on the chilly side, so Sparhawk did not linger very long. He wrapped himself in a soft white robe and went through the dim corridors of the palace to the brightly lighted kitchens, where Khalad waited with a sleepy-looking Kaltan.
"Hail, noble prince consort," Kaltan said dryly.
Sir Kaltan obviously didn't care much for the idea of being roused in the middle of the night.
"Hail, noble boyhood companion of the noble prince consort," Sparhawk replied.
"Now there's a cumbersome title," Kaltan said sourly. "What's so important that it won't wait until morning?" Sparhawk sat down at one of the work tables, and a white-smocked baker brought him a plate of roast beef and a steaming loaf still hot from the oven.
"Thanks, neighbor," Sparhawk said to him.
"Where have you been, Sparhawk?"
Kaltan demanded, sitting down across the table from his friend. Kaltan had a wine flagon in one hand and a tin cup in the other.
"Sarathi sent me to Lamorkand,"
Sparhawk replied, tearing a chunk of bread from the loaf.
"Your wife's been making life miserable for everyone in the palace, you know."
"It's nice to know she cares."
"Not for the rest of us, it isn't. What did Dolmont need from Lamorkand?"
"Information. He didn't altogether believe some of the reports he's been getting."
"What's not to believe? The Lamorks are just engaging in their national pastime, civil war."
"There seems to be something a little different this time. Do you remember Count Garrick,
the one who had us besieged in Baron Alstrom's castle? I never met him personally, but his name's sort of familiar.
He seems to be coming out on top in the squabbles in western Lamorkand, and most everybody up there believes that he's got his eye on the throne."
"So?"
Kaltan helped himself to part of Sparhawk's loaf of bread.
"Every baron in Lamorkand has his eyes on the throne.
What's got Dolmont so concerned about it this time?
Garrick's been making alliances beyond the borders of Lemurkand. Some of those border barons in Pelosia are more or less independent of King Soros.
Everybody in Pelosia's independent of Soros. He isn't much of a king. He spends too much time praying.
That's a strange position for a soldier of God, Khalad murmured.
You've got to keep these things in perspective, Khalad, Kalton told him. Too much praying softens a man's brains.
Anyway, Sparhawk went on, if Garrick succeeds in dragging those Pelosian barons into his bid for King Fridal's throne, Fridal's going to have to declare war on Pelosia. The church already has a war going on in Rendor, and Dolmont's not very enthusiastic about a second front. He paused. I ran across something else, though, he added. I overheard a conversation I wasn't supposed to. The name Drichtnath came up. Do you know anything about him? Kalton shrugged.
He was the national hero of the Lamorks way back. They say he was about 12 feet tall, ate an ox for breakfast every morning, and drank a hogshead of mead every evening. The story has it that he could shatter rocks by scowling at them and reach up and stop the sun with one hand. The stories might be just a little bit exaggerated, though.
Very funny. The group I overheard were all telling each other that he's returned.
That'd be a neat trick. I gather that his closest friend killed him, stabbed him in the back, and then ran a spear through his heart. You know how Lamorks are.
That's a strange name, Khalad noted. What does it mean?
Drichtnath?
Kalton scratched his head.
Dreadnought, I think. Lamork mothers do that sort of thing to their children.
He drained his cup and tipped his flagon over it. A few drops came out.
Are we going to be much longer at this? He asked. If we're going to sit up talking all night, I'll get more wine. To be honest with you, though, Sparhawk, I'd really rather go back to my nice warm bed.
And your nice warm chambermaid? Khalad added.
She gets lonesome.
Kalton shrugged. His face grew serious.
If the Lamorks are talking about Drichtnath again, it means that they're starting to feel a little confined. Drichtnath wanted to rule the world, and any time the Lamorks start invoking his name, it's a fair indication that they're beginning to look beyond their borders for elbow room.
Sparhawk pushed back his plate. It's too late at night to start worrying about it now. Go back to bed, Kalton. You too, Khalad. We can talk more about this tomorrow. I really ought to go pay a courtesy call on my wife. He stood up.
That's all? Kalton said. A courtesy call?
There are many forms of courtesy, Kalton. The corridors in the palace were dimly illuminated by widely spaced candles. Sparhawk went quietly past the throne room to the royal apartment. As usual, Mirtai dozed in a chair beside the door. Sparhawk stopped and considered the Tamil giantess. When her face was in repose, she was heart-stoppingly beautiful. Her skin was golden in the candlelight, and her eyelashes were so long that they touched her cheeks. Her sword lay in her lap with her hand lightly enclosing its hilt. "Don't try to sneak up on me, Sparhawk." She said it without opening her eyes.
"How did you know it was me?"
I could smell you. All you Alines seem to forget that we have noses.
How could you possibly smell me? I just took a bath.
Yes, I noticed that too. You should have taken the time to let the water heat up a little more.
Sometimes you amaze me. Do you know that?
You're easily amazed, Sparhawk. She opened her eyes. Where have you been? Elana's been nearly frantic.
How is she?
About the same. Aren't you ever going to let her grow up? I'm getting very tired of being owned by a child. In Mirtai's own eyes, she was a slave, the property of Queen Elana. This in no way hindered her in ruling the royal family of Alenia with an iron fist, arbitrarily deciding what was good for them and what was not. She had brusquely dismissed all the queen's attempts to emancipate her, pointing out that she was an Aton Tamil, and that her race was temperamentally unsuited for freedom. Sparhawk tended strongly to agree with her, since he was fairly certain that if she were left to follow her instincts, Mirtai could depopulate several fair-sized towns in short order. She stood up, rising to her feet with exquisite grace. She was a good 4 inches taller than Sparhawk, and he felt again that odd sense of shrinking as he looked up at her. "What took you so long?" she asked him. "I had to go to Lamorkand." "Was that your idea, or somebody else's?" "Dolmot sent me." "Make sure Elana understands that right from the start. If she thinks you went there on your own, the fight will last for weeks, and all that wrangling gets on my nerves." She produced the key to the royal apartment and gave Sparhawk a blunt, direct look. "Be very attentive, Sparhawk. She's missed you a great deal, and she needs some tangible evidence of your affection. And don't forget to bolt the bedroom door. Your daughter might be just a little young to be learning about certain things." She unlocked the door. "Mirtai, do you really have to lock us all in every night?" "Yes, I do. I can't get to sleep until I know that none of you is out wandering around the halls." Sparhawk sighed. "Oh, by the way," he added, "Kring was in Kyrellos. I imagine he'll be along in a few days to propose marriage to you again."
"It's about time," she smiled. "It's been 3 months since his last proposal. I was beginning to think he didn't love me anymore."
"Are you ever going to accept him?"
"We'll see. Go wake up your wife, Sparhawk. I'll let you out in the morning."
She gently pushed him through the doorway and locked the door behind him. Sparhawk's daughter, Princess Danae, was curled up in a large chair by the fire. Danae was 6 years old now. Her hair was very dark, and her skin as white as milk. Her dark eyes were large, and her mouth a small pink bow. She was quite the little lady, her manner serious and very grown up. Her constant companion, nonetheless, was a battered and disreputable-looking stuffed toy animal named Rollo. Rollo had descended to Princess Danae from her mother. As usual, Princess Danae's little feet had greenish grass stains on them. "You're late, Sparhawk," she said flatly to her father. "Danae," he said to her, "you know you're not supposed to call me by name like that. If your mother hears you, she's going to start asking questions."
"She's asleep," Danae shrugged.
"Are you really sure about that?" She gave him a withering look.
"Of course I am. I'm not going to make any mistakes. I've done this many, many times before, you know. Where have you been?"
"I had to go to Lamorkand."
"Didn't it occur to you to send word to Mother? She's been absolutely unbearable for the last few weeks."
"I know. Any number of people have already told me about it. I didn't really think I'd be gone for so long." "I'm glad you're awake. Maybe you can help me with something."
"I'll consider it, if you're nice to me."
"Stop that. What do you know about Drixnoth?"
"He was a barbarian, but he was an Aline, after all, so it was probably only natural."
"Your prejudices are showing."
"Nobody's perfect. Why this sudden interest in ancient history?"
"There's a wild story running through Lamorkand that Drixnoth returned. They're all sitting around sharpening swords with exalted expressions on their faces. What's the real significance of that?"
"He was their king 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. It was shortly after you Alines discovered fire and came out of your caves."
"Be nice."
"Yes, father. Anyway, Drixnoth hammered all the Lamorks into something that sort of resembled unity, and then set out to conquer the world. The Lamorks were very impressed with him. He worshipped the old Lamork gods, though, and your Aline church was a little uncomfortable with the notion of a pagan sitting on the throne of the whole world, so she had him murdered."
"The church wouldn't do that," he said flatly.
"Did you want to listen to the story, or did you want to argue theology?" "After Drixnoth died, the Lamork priests disemboweled a few chickens and fondled their entrails in order to read the future. That's really a disgusting practice, Sparhawk. It's so messy." She shuddered.
"Don't blame me. I didn't think it up."
"The auguries, as they called them, said that one day Drichtnath would return to take up where he'd left off, and that he'd lead the Lamorks to world domination.
You mean they actually believe that?
They did once.
There are some rumors up there of backsliding, reversion to the worship of the old pagan gods.
It's the sort of thing you'd expect. When a Lamork starts thinking about Drichtnath, he automatically hauls the old gods out of the closet. It's so foolish. Aren't there enough real gods for them?
The old Lamork gods aren't real, then?
Of course not. Where's your mind, Sparhawk?
The troll gods are real. What's the difference?
There's all the difference in the world, Father. Any child can see that.
Why don't I just take your word for it? And why don't you go back to bed?
Because you haven't kissed me yet.
Oh, sorry. I had my mind on something else.
Keep your eye on the important things, Sparhawk. Do you want to have me wither away?
Of course not.
Then give me a kiss.
He did that. As always, she smelled of grass and trees. Wash your feet, he told her.
Oh, bother, she said.
Do you want to spend a week explaining those grass stains to your mother?
That's all I get, she protested. One meager little kiss and bathing instructions?
He laughed, picked her up, and kissed her again, several times. Then he put her down. Now scoot. She pouted a little, and then sighed. She started back toward her bedroom, negligently carrying Rollo by one hind leg.
Don't keep Mother up all night, she said back over her shoulder. And please, try to be quiet. Why do you two always have to make so much noise?
She looked impishly back over her shoulder.
Why are you blushing, Father?
She asked innocently. Then she laughed and went on into her own room and closed the door.
He could never be sure if his daughter really understood the implications of such remarks, although he was certain that one level, at least, of her strangely layered personality understood quite well. He made sure that her door was latched, and then went into the bedroom he shared with his wife. He closed and bolted the door behind him. The fire had burned down to embers, but there was still sufficient light for him to be able to see the young woman who was the focus of his entire life. Her wealth of pale blonde hair covered her pillow, and in sleep she looked very young and vulnerable. He stood at the foot of the bed looking at her. There were still traces in her face of the little girl he had trained and molded. He sighed. That train of thought always made him melancholy, because it brought home the fact that he was really too old for her. Elana should have a young husband, someone less battered, certainly someone handsome. He idly wondered where he had made the mistake that had so welded her affection to him that she had not even considered any other possible choice. It had probably been something minor, insignificant even. Who could ever know what kind of effect even the tiniest gesture might have on another? "I know you're there, Sparhawk," she said without even opening her eyes. There was a slight edge to her voice.
"I was admiring the view."
A light tone might head off the incipient unpleasantness, though he didn't really have much hope of that. She opened her gray eyes. "Come over here," she commanded, holding her arms out to him.
"I was ever your Majesty's most obedient servant."
He grinned at her, going to the side of the bed. "Oh, really?" she replied, wrapping her arms about his neck and kissing him. He kissed her back. And that went on for quite some time.
"Do you suppose we could save the scolding until tomorrow morning, love?" he asked.
"I'm a little tired tonight. Why don't we do the kissing and making up now, and you can scold me later?" "And lose my edge? Don't be silly. I've been saving up all sorts of things to say to you."
"I can imagine. Golmont sent me to Lamorkan to look into something. It took me a little longer than I expected."
"That's not fair, Sparhawk," she accused.
"I didn't follow that."
"You weren't supposed to say that yet. You're supposed to wait until after I've demanded an explanation before you give me one. Now you've gone and spoiled it."
"Can you ever forgive me?"
He assumed an expression of exaggerated contrition and kissed her on the neck. His wife, he had discovered, loved these little games. She laughed. I'll think about it. She kissed him back. The women of his family were a very demonstrative little group, he decided. All right, then, she said. You've gone and spoiled it anyway, so you might as well tell me what you were doing and why you didn't send word that you'd be delayed.
Politics, love. You know Dolmont. Lamorcand is right on the verge of exploding. Sarathi wanted a professional assessment, but he didn't want it generally known that I was going there at his instruction. He didn't want any messages explaining things floating around.
I think it's time for me to have a little talk with our revered arch-prelate, Elana said. He seems to have a little trouble remembering just who I am.
I don't recommend it, Elana.
I'm not going to start a fight with him, my love. I'm just going to point out to him that he's ignoring the customary courtesies. He's supposed to ask before he commandeers my husband. I'm getting just a little weary of his imperial arch-prelacy, so I'm going to teach him some manners.
Can I watch? That might just be a very interesting conversation.
Sparhawk, she said, giving him a smoldering look. If you want to avoid an official reprimand, you're going to have to start taking some significant steps to soften my displeasure.
I was just getting to that, he told her, enfolding her in a tighter embrace.
What took you so long? She breathed. It was quite a bit later, and the displeasure of the Queen of Alenia seemed to be definitely softening. What did you find out in Lamorcand, Sparhawk? She asked, stretching languorously. Politics were never really very far from the Queen's mind.
Western Lamorcan's in turmoil right now. There's a count up there. Garrick, his name is. We ran across him when we were searching for Bellium. He was involved with Martell in one of those elaborate schemes devised to keep the militant orders out of Kyrellos during the election.
That speaks volumes about this count's character.
Perhaps. But Martell was very good at manipulating people. He stirred up a small war between Garrick and Patriarch Ortzel's brother. Anyway, the campaign appears to have broadened the Count's horizons a bit. He's begun to have some thoughts about the throne.
Poor Freddy, Elana sighed.
King Fridal of Lamorcand was her distant cousin.
You couldn't give me that throne of his. Why should the Church be concerned, though? Freddy's got a large enough army to deal with one ambitious count.
It's not quite so simple, love. Garrick has been concluding alliances with other nobles in western Lamorcand. He's amassed an army nearly as big as the king's, and he's been talking with the Pelosian barons around Lake Ven.
Those bandits, she said with a certain contempt. Anybody can buy them.
You're well versed in the politics of the region, Elana.
I almost have to be, Sparhawk. Pelosia fronts my northeastern border. Does this current disturbance threaten us in any way?
Not at the moment. Garrick has his eyes turned eastward, toward the capital.
Maybe I should offer Freddy an alliance, she mused. If general war breaks out in the region, I could snip off a nice piece of southwestern Pelosia.
Are we developing territorial ambitions, Your Majesty?
Not tonight, Sparhawk, she replied. I've got other things on my mind tonight. And she reached out to him again. It was quite a bit later, almost dawn. Elana's regular breathing told Sparhawk that she was asleep. He slipped from the bed and went to the window. His years of military training made it automatic for him to take a look at the weather just before daybreak. The rain had abated, but the wind had picked up. It was early spring now, and there was little hope for decent weather for weeks. He was glad that he had reached home when he had, since the approaching day looked unpromising. He stared out at the torches flaring and tossing in the windy courtyard. As they always did when the weather was bad, Sparhawk's thoughts drifted back to the years he had spent in the sun-blasted city of Jirok, on the arid north coast of Rendor, where the women, all veiled and robed in black, went to the well in the steely first light of day, and where the woman named Lilius had consumed his nights with what she chose to call love. He did not, however, remember that night in Cypria,
when Martell's assassins had quite nearly spilled out his life. He had settled that score with Martell in the Temple of Azash in Zemok, so there was no real purpose in remembering the stockyard of Cypria, nor the sound of the monastery bells that had called to him out of the darkness. That momentary sense of being watched, the sense that had come over him in the narrow street while he had been on his way to the palace, still nagged at him. Something he did not understand was going on, and he fervently wished that he could talk with Sophronia about it. Chapter 2
"Your Majesty," the Earl of Lenda protested, "you can't address this kind of language to the arch-prelate."
Lenda was staring with chagrin at the piece of paper the Queen had just handed him.
"You've done everything but accuse him of being a thief and a scoundrel." "Oh, did I leave those out?" she asked. "How careless of me."
They were meeting in the blue-carpeted council chamber, as they usually did at this time of the morning.
"Can't you do something with her, Sparhawk?" Lenda pleaded.
"Oh, Lenda," Elana laughed, smiling at the frail old man.
"That's only a draft. I was a little irritated when I scribbled it down." "A little?"
"I know we can't send the letter in its present form, my lord. I just wanted you to know how I really felt about the matter before we rephrase it and couch it in diplomatic language. My whole point is that Dolmont's beginning to overstep his bounds. He's the arch-prelate, not the emperor. The church has too much authority over temporal affairs already, and if someone doesn't bring Dolmont up short, every monarch in Eosia will become little more than his vassal. I'm sorry, gentlemen. I am a true daughter of the church, but I won't kneel to Dolmont and receive my crown back from him in some contrived little ceremony that has no purpose other than my humiliation."
Sparhawk was a bit surprised at his wife's political maturity.
The power structure on the Eosian continent had always depended on a rather delicate balance between the authority of the church and the power of the various kings. When that balance was disturbed, things went awry.
"Her Majesty's point may be well taken, Lenda," he said thoughtfully. "The Eosian monarchies haven't been very strong for the last generation or so. Aldrius was..."
He groped for a word.
"Inept,"
his wife coolly characterized her own father.
"I might not have gone quite that far," he murmured. "Wargan's erratic. Soros is a religious hysteric. Obler's old, and Friedal reigns only at the sufferance of his barons. Dragos lets his relatives make all his decisions. King Brycent of Camoria is a voluptuary, and I don't even know the name of the current king of Rendor."
"Ogerin," Calton supplied.
"Not that it really matters."
"Anyway," Sparhawk continued, sinking lower in his chair and rubbing the side of his face thoughtfully, "during this same period of time, we've had a number of very able churchmen in the hierocracy. The incapacity of Cluvonus sort of encouraged the patriarchs to strike out on their own. If you had a vacant throne someplace, you could do a lot worse than put Emban on it, or Ortzel, or Bergsten, and even Anias had a very high degree of political skill. When kings grow weak, the church grows strong. Too strong, sometimes."
"Spit it out, Sparhawk," Platymy growled. "Are you trying to say we should declare war on the church?"
"Not today, Platymy. We might want to keep the idea in reserve, though. Right now, I think it's time to start sending some signals to Kyrellos, and our queen may be just the one to send them. After the way she stampeded the hierocracy during Dolmont's election, I think they'll listen very carefully to just about anything she says. I don't know that I'd soften her letter all that much, Lenda. Let's see if we can get their attention."
Lenda's eyes were very bright. "This is the way the game's supposed to be played, my friends," he said enthusiastically.
"You do realize that it's altogether possible that Dolmont didn't realize that he was stepping over the line," Calton noted. "Maybe he sent Sparhawk to Lamorkand as the interim preceptor of the Pandion Order, and completely overlooked the fact that he's also the Prince Consort. Sarathi's got a lot on his mind just now."
"If he's that absent-minded, he's got no business occupying the Archprelate's throne,"
Elana asserted. Her eyes narrowed, always a dangerous sign.
Let's make it very clear to him that he's hurt my feelings. He'll go out of his way to smooth things over, and maybe I can take advantage of that to retrieve that duchy just north of Vardenay. Linda, is there any way we can keep people from bequeathing their estates to the church?
It's a long-standing custom, Your Majesty.
I know, but the land originally comes from the crown.
Shouldn't we have some say in who inherits it?
You'd think that if a nobleman dies without an heir, the estate would revert back to me. But every time there's a childless noble in Alenia, the churchmen flock around him like vultures, trying to talk him into giving them the land.
Jerksome titles, Platamy suggested. Make it a law that if a man doesn't have an heir, he doesn't keep his estate.
The aristocracy would go up in flames, Linda gasped.
That's what the army's for, Platamy said with a shrug. To put out fires. I'll tell you what, Elana. You pass the law, and I'll arrange a few very public and very messy accidents for the ones who scream the loudest. Aristocrats aren't very bright, but they'll get the point. Eventually.
Do you think I could get away with that? Elana asked the Earl of Lenda.
Surely your Majesty's not seriously considering it.
I have to do something, Lenda. The church is eating up my kingdom acre by acre, and once she takes possession of an estate, the land's removed from the tax rolls forever.
She paused.
This could just be a way to do what Sparhawk suggested. Get the church's attention. Why don't we draw up a draft of some outrageously repressive law, and just accidentally let a copy fall into the hands of some middle-level clergyman? It's probably safe to say that it'll be in Dolmont's hands before the ink's dry.
That's really unscrupulous, my queen, Linda told her.
I'm so glad you approve, my lord. She looked around. Have we got anything else this morning, gentlemen?
You've got some unauthorized bandits operating in the mountains near Cardos, Elana, Platamy rumbled.
The gross, black-bearded man sat with his feet upon the table. There was a wine flagon and goblet at his elbow. His doublet was wrinkled and food-spotted, and his shaggy hair hung down over his forehead, almost covering his eyes. Platamy was constitutionally incapable of using formal titles, but the queen chose to overlook that.
Unauthorized?
Calton sounded amused.
You know what I mean, Platamy growled. They don't have permission from the Thieves' Council to operate in that region, and they're breaking all the rules. I'm not positive, but I think there's some of the former henchmen of the Primate of Simura. You blundered there, Elana. You should have waited until you had them in custody before you declared them outlaws.
Oh, well, she shrugged. Nobody's perfect. Elana's relationship with Platamy was peculiar. She realized that he was unable to mouth the polite formulas of the nobility, and so she accepted a bluntness from him that would have offended her had it come from anyone else. For all his faults, Platamy was turning into a gifted, almost brilliant counselor, and Elana valued his advice greatly. I'm not surprised to find out that Anaya's old cronies have turned to highway robbery in their hour of need. They were all bandits to begin with, anyway. There have always been outlaws in those mountains, though, so I doubt that another band will make all that much difference.
Elana, he sighed, you're the same as my very own baby sister. But sometimes you're terribly ignorant. An authorized bandit knows the rules. He knows which travelers can be robbed or killed, and which ones have to be left alone. Nobody gets too excited if some overstuffed merchant gets his throat cut and his purse lifted. But if a government official or a high-ranking nobleman turns up dead in those mountains, the authorities have to take steps to at least make it appear that they're doing their jobs. That sort of official attention is very bad for business. Perfectly innocent criminals get rounded up and hanged. Highway robbery is not an occupation for amateurs. And there's another problem as well. These bandits are telling all the local peasantry that they're not really robbers, but patriots rebelling against a cruel tyrant. That's you, little sister. There's always enough discontent among the peasants to make some of them sympathetic toward that sort of thing. You aristocrats haven't any business getting involved in crime. You always try to mix politics in with it.
But, my dear Platini, she said winsomely, I thought you knew. Politics is a crime.
The fat man roared with laughter. I love this girl, he told the others. Don't worry too much about it, Elana. I'll try to get some men inside their band. And when Stragan gets back, we'll put our heads together and work out some way to put those people out of business.
I knew I could count on you, she said. She rose to her feet. If that's all we have, gentlemen, I have an appointment with my dressmaker. She looked around. Coming, Sparhawk?
In a moment, he replied. I want to have a word with Platini. She nodded and moved toward the door. What's on your mind, Sparhawk? Platini asked. I saw Naween last night when I rode into town. She's working the streets. Naween? That's ridiculous. Half the time she even forgets to take the money.
That's what I told her. She and Shanda had a falling out, and she was standing on a street corner near the east gate. I sent her to an inn to get her out of the weather. Can we make some kind of arrangement for her?
I'll see what I can do, Platini promised.
Elana had not yet left the room, and Sparhawk sometimes forgot how sharp her ears were. Who's this Naween? She asked from the doorway with a slight edge to her voice.
She's a whore, Platini shrugged. A special friend of Sparhawk's.
Platini? Sparhawk gasped. Isn't she?
Well, I suppose so, but when you say it that way... Sparhawk groped for the right words.
Oh, I didn't mean it that way, Elana. So far as I know, your husband's completely faithful to you. Naween's a whore. That's her occupation. But it doesn't have anything to do with her friendship. Not that she didn't make Sparhawk some offers, but she makes those offers to everybody. She's a very generous girl.
Please, Platini, Sparhawk groaned. Don't be on my side anymore.
Naween's a good girl, Platini continued to explain to Elana. She works hard, she takes good care of her customers, and she pays her taxes.
Taxes? Elana exclaimed. Are you telling me that my government encourages that sort of thing? Legitimizes it by taxing it?
Have you been living on the moon, Elana? Of course she pays taxes. We all do. Lend us ease to that. Naween helped Sparhawk once while you were sick. He was looking for that Krager fellow, and she helped him. Like I said, she offered him other services as well, but he turned her down, politely. She's always been a bit disappointed in him about that.
You and I are going to have a long talk about this, Sparhawk, Elana said ominously.
As your majesty wishes.
He sighed as she swept coolly from the room.
She doesn't know very much about the real world, does she, Sparhawk? It's her sheltered upbringing. I thought you were the one who brought her up.
That's right.
Then you've only got yourself to blame. I'll have Naween stop by and explain it all to her. Are you out of your mind?
Talon came in from Demos the next day, riding into the courtyard with Sir Barrett. Sparhawk and Khalad met them at the stable door. The prince consort was making some effort to be inconspicuous until such time as the queen's curiosity about Naween diminished. Talon's nose was red, and his eyes looked puffy.
I thought you were going to stay at the farm until you got over that cold, Sparhawk said to him.
I couldn't stand all that mothering, Talon said, slipping down from his saddle. One mother is bad enough, but my brothers and I have two now. I don't think I'll ever be able to look another bowl of chicken soup in the face again. Hello, Khalad.
Talon,
Sparhawk's burly young squire grunted. He looked critically at his half-brother.
Your eyes look terrible.
You ought to see them from in here.
Talon was about 15 now, and he was going through one of those stages. Sparhawk was fairly certain that the young thief had grown 3 inches in the past month and a half.
A goodly amount of forearm and wrist struck out of the sleeves of his doublet.
"Do you think the cooks might have something to eat?" the boy asked.
As a result of his rapid growth, Talon ate almost constantly now.
"I've got some papers for you to sign, Sparhawk," Barrett said. "It's nothing very urgent, but I thought I'd ride in with Talon." Barrett wore a mail shirt, and he had a broadsword belted at his waist. His weapon of choice, however, was still the heavy war axe slung to his saddle.
"Are you going back to the chapter house?" Khalad asked him.
"Unless Sparhawk has something he wants me for here."
"I'll ride along with you then. Sir Allard wants to give us more instruction with the lance this afternoon."
"Why don't you just unhorse him a few times?" Barrett suggested. "Then he'll leave you alone. You could do it, you know. You're already better than he is."
Khalad shrugged. "And it hurt his feelings."
"Not to mention his ribs, shoulders, and back." Barrett laughed.
"It's a bit ostentatious to outperform your instructors," Khalad said. "The other novices are already a little sulky about the way my brothers and I are showing them up. We've tried to explain, but they're sensitive about the fact that we're peasants. You know how that goes."
He looked inquiringly at Sparhawk.
"Are you going to need me for anything this afternoon, my lord?"
"No. Go ahead and dent Sir Allard's armor a bit. He's got an exaggerated notion of his own skill. Give him some instruction in the virtue of humility."
"I'm really hungry, Sparhawk," Talon complained.
"All right, let's go to the kitchen." Sparhawk looked critically at his young friend.
"Then I guess we'll have to send for the tailor again," he added. "You're growing like a weed."
"It's not my idea."
Khalad started to saddle his horse, and Sparhawk and Talon went into the palace in search of food. It was about an hour later when the two of them entered the royal apartment to find Elana, Mirtai, and Danae sitting by the fire. Elana was leafing through some documents, Danae was playing with Rollo, and Mirtai was sharpening one of her daggers.
"Well," Elana said, looking up from the documents, "if it isn't my noble prince consort and my wandering page."
Talon bowed. Then he sniffed loudly.
"Use your handkerchief," Mirtai told him.
"Yes, ma'am."
"How are your mothers?"
Elana asked the young man. Everyone, perhaps unconsciously, used that phrase when speaking to Talon and his half-brothers. In a very real sense, though, the usage reflected reality. As Slady and Elis mothered Kurik's 5 sons excessively and impartially.
"Meddlesome, my queen," Talon replied. "It's not really a good idea to get sick in that house. In the last week, I think I've been dosed with every cold remedy known to man."
A peculiar squeaky noise came from somewhere in the general vicinity of the young man's midsection.
"Is that your stomach?" Mirtai asked him. "Are you hungry again?"
"No, I just ate. I probably won't get hungry again for at least 15 minutes.
Talon put one hand to the front of his doublet.
"The little beast was being so quiet I almost forgot it was there."
He went over to Danae, who was tying the strings of a little bonnet under the chin of her stuffed toy.
"I've brought a present for you, princess," he said.
Her eyes brightened. She set Rollo aside and sat waiting expectantly.
"But no kissing," he added. "Just a thank you will do. I've got a cold, and you don't want to catch it."
"What did you bring me?"
she asked eagerly.
"Oh, just a little something I found under a bush out on the road. It's a little wet and muddy, but you can dry it out and brush it off, I suppose. It's not much, but I thought you might like it."
"Just a little."
Talon was underplaying it for all he was worth.
"Could I see it, please?"
she begged.
"Oh, I suppose so."
He reached inside his doublet, took out a rather bedraggled gray kitten, and set it on the floor in front of her. The kitten had mackerel stripes, a spiky tail, large ears, and an intently curious look in its blue eyes. It took a tentative step toward its new mistress. Danae squealed with delight, picked up the kitten, and hugged it to her cheek.
"I love it!" she exclaimed.
"There go the draperies," Mirtai said with resignation. "Kittens always want to climb the drapes.
Talon skillfully fended off Sparhawk's exuberant little daughter.
"The cold, Danae," the boy warned. "I've got a cold, remember?"
Sparhawk was certain that his daughter would grow more skilled with the passage of time, and that it wouldn't be very long until Talon would no longer be able to evade her affection. The kitten had been no more than a gesture, Sparhawk was certain, some spur-of-the-moment impulse to which Talon had given no thought whatsoever. It rather effectively sealed the young man's fate, however. A few days before, Sparhawk had idly wondered where he had made the mistake that had permanently attached his wife's affection to him. He realized that this scruffy-looking kitten was Talon's mistake, or at least one of them. Sparhawk mentally shrugged. Talon would make an adequate son-in-law, once Danae had trained him. "Is it all right, Your Majesty?" Talon was asking the Queen. "For her to have the kitten, I mean." "Isn't it just a little late to be asking that question, Talon?" Ilana replied. "Oh, I don't know," he said impudently. "I thought I'd timed it just about right." Ilana looked at her daughter, who was snuggling the kitten against her face. All cats are born opportunists. The kitten patted the little girl's cheek with one soft paw, and then nuzzled. Kittens are expert nuzzlers.
"How can I say no after you've already given it to her, Talon?"
"It would be a little difficult, wouldn't it, Your Majesty?" The boy sniffed loudly. Mirtai rose to her feet, put her dagger away, and crossed the room to Talon. She reached out her hand, and he flinched away.
"Oh, stop that," she told him.
She laid her hand on his forehead.
"You've got a fever."
"I didn't get it on purpose."
"We'd better get him to bed, Mirtai," Ilana said, rising from her chair.
"We should sweat him first," the giantess said. "I'll take him to the bathhouse and steam him for a while."
She took Talon's arm firmly.
"You're not going into the bathhouse with me," he protested,
his face suddenly aflame.
"Be quiet," she commanded. "Send word to the cooks, Ilana. Have them stir up a mustard plaster and boil up some chicken soup. When I bring him back from the bathhouse, we'll put the mustard plaster on his chest, pop him into bed, and spoon soup into him."
"Are you going to just stand there and let them do this to me, Sparhawk?"
Talon appealed. "I'd like to help you, my friend," Sparhawk replied. "But I've got my own health to consider, too, you know."
"I wish I was dead," Talon groaned, as Mirtai pulled him from the room.
Stragan and Ulath arrived from Emsat a few days later, and were immediately escorted to the royal apartment.
"You're getting fat, Sparhawk," Ulath said bluntly, removing his ogre-horned helmet.
"I've put on a few pounds," Sparhawk conceded.
"Soft living,"
Ulath grunted disapprovingly.
"How's Wargan?"
Ilana asked the huge blonde Thalesian.
"His mind's gone," Ulath replied sadly. "They've got him locked up in the west wing of the palace. He spends most of his time raving."
Ilana sighed.
"I always rather liked him, when he was sober."
"I doubt that you'll feel the same way about his son, Your Majesty," Stragan told her dryly.
Like Platymi, Stragan was a thief, but he had much better manners.
"I've never met him," Ilana said.
"You might consider adding that to your next prayer of thanksgiving, Your Majesty. His name's Avon. A short and insignificant name for a short and insignificant fellow. He doesn't show very much promise."
"Is he really that bad?"
Ilana asked Ulath.
"Avon Wargensen? Stragan's being generous. Avon's a little man who spends all his time trying to make sure that people don't overlook him. When he found out that I was coming here, he called me to the palace and gave me a royal communication to bring to you. He spent 2 hours trying to impress me."
"Were you impressed?"
"Not particularly, no."
Ulath reached inside his surcoat and drew out a folded and sealed sheet of parchment.
"What does it say?"
she asked.
"I wouldn't know. I don't read other people's mail. My guess is that it's a serious discussion of the weather. Avon Wargensen's desperately afraid that people might forget about him, so every traveler who leaves Emsat is loaded down with royal greetings." "How was the trip?"
Sparhawk asked them.
I can't really say that I'd recommend sea travel at this time of year, Stragan replied. His icy blue eyes hardened. I want to have a little talk with Platymi. Ulath and I were set upon by some brigands in the mountains between here and Cardos. Bandits are supposed to know better than that.
They aren't professionals, Sparhawk told him. Platymi knows about them, and he's going to take steps. Were there any problems?
Not for us, Ulath shrugged. The amateurs out there didn't have a very good day, though. We left five of them in a ditch, and then the rest all remembered an important engagement somewhere else.
He went to the door and looked out into the hall. Then he closed the door and looked around, his eyes wary.
Are there any servants or people like that in any of your rooms here, Sparhawk? He asked.
Mirtai and our daughter is all.
That's all right. I think we can trust them.
Komie sent me to let you know that Avon Wargensen's been in contact with Count Garrick down in Lammerkand. Garrick's taking a run at King Fridal's throne, and Avon's not quite bright. He doesn't know enough to stay out of the internal squabbles in Lammerkand. Komie thinks there might just possibly be some sort of secret arrangement between them. Patriarch Bergston's taking the same message to Kyrellos.
Count Garrick's going to start to irritate Dolmont if he doesn't watch what he's doing, Elana said. He's trying to make alliances every time he turns around, and he knows that's a violation of the rules. Lamorque civil wars aren't supposed to involve other kingdoms.
That's an actual rule? Stragan asked her incredulously.
Of course. It's been in place for 1,000 years. If the Lamorque barons were free to form alliances with nobles in other kingdoms, they'd plunge the continent into war every 10 years. That used to happen until the church stepped in and told them to stop.
And you thought our society had peculiar rules? Stragan laughed to Platymi.
This is entirely different, Milord Stragan, Elana told him in a lofty tone. Our peculiarities are matters of state policy. Yours are simply good common sense. There's a world of difference.
So I gather.
Sparhawk was looking at all three of them when it happened, so there was no doubt that when he felt that peculiar chill and caught that faint flicker of darkness at the very outer edge of his vision, they did as well.
Sparhawk! Elana cried in alarm.
Yes, he replied. I know. I saw it too.
Stragan had half-drawn his rapier, his hand moving with cat-like speed.
What is it? He demanded, looking around the room.
An impossibility, Elana said flatly.
The look she gave her husband was a little less certain, however.
Isn't it, Sparhawk?
Her voice trembled slightly.
I certainly thought so, he replied. This isn't the time to be cryptic, Stragan said.
Then the chill and the shadow passed. Ulath looked speculatively at Sparhawk.
Was that what I thought it was? He asked. So it seems. Will someone please tell me what's going on here? Stragan demanded.
Do you remember that cloud that followed us up in Pelosia? Ulath said.
Of course. But that was Azash, wasn't it?
No. We thought so. But Afriel told us that we were wrong. That was after you came back here, so you probably didn't hear about it. That shadow we just saw was the troll gods. They're inside the Bellium.
Inside?
They needed a place to hide after they'd lost a few arguments with the younger gods of Styricum. Stragan looked at Sparhawk.
I thought you told me that you'd thrown Bellium into the sea.
We did.
And the troll gods can't get out of it?
That's what we were led to believe.
You should have found a deeper ocean.
There aren't any deeper ones.
That's too bad. It looks as if someone's managed to fish it out.
It's logical, Sparhawk, Ulath said. That box was lined with gold, and Afriel told us that the gold would keep Bellium from getting out on its own. Since the troll gods can't get out of Bellium, they were down there, too.
Somebody's found that box. I've heard that the people who dive for pearls can go down quite deep, Stragan said.
Not that deep, Sparhawk said. Besides,
There's something wrong.
Are you just now realizing that?
Stregan asked him. That's not what I mean. When we were up in Pelosia, you could all see that cloud.
Oh, yes,
Uloth said fervently. But before that, when it was just a shadow, only Elana and I could see it, and that was because we were wearing the rings. This was definitely a shadow and not a cloud, wasn't it?
Yes,
Stregan admitted.
Then how is it that you and Uloth could see it too?
Stregan spread his hands helplessly. There's something else as well, Sparhawk added. The night I came home from Lammerkant, I felt something in the street watching me. Several somethings. They weren't Aline or Styric, and I don't think they were human. That shadow that just passed through here felt exactly the same.
I wish there was some way we could talk with Sephrenia, Uloth muttered.
Sparhawk was fairly certain that there was a way, but he was not free to reveal it to any of them.
Do we tell anybody else about this? Stregan asked.
Let's not start a panic until we find out more about it, Sparhawk decided.
Right, Stregan agreed. There's always plenty of time for panic later. Plenty of reason, too, I think.
The weather cleared over the next few days, and that fact alone lifted spirits in the palace. Sparhawk spent some time closeted with Platymi and Stregan, and then the two thieves sent men into Lammerkand to investigate the situation there.
That's what I should have done in the first place, Sparhawk said. But Sarathi wouldn't give me the chance. Our revered arch-prelate has a few blind spots. He can't seem to get it through his head that official investigators aren't going to ever really get to the bottom of things.
Typical aristocratic ineptitude, Stregan drawled.
It's one of the things that makes life easier for people like Platymi and me.
Sparhawk didn't argue with him about that.
Just tell your men to be careful, he cautioned them. Lamorks tend to try to solve all their problems with daggers, and dead spies don't bring home very much useful information.
Astonishing insight there, old boy, Stregan said, his rich voice dripping with irony. It's absolutely amazing that Platymi and I never thought of that.
All right, Sparhawk admitted. Maybe I was being just a little obvious.
We saw that too, didn't we, Platymi?
Platymi grunted.
Tell Elana that I'm going to be away from the palace for a few days, Sparhawk.
Where are you going?
None of your business. There's something I want to take care of.
All right, but keep in touch.
You're being obvious again, Sparhawk.
The fat man scratched his paunch.
I'll talk with Talon. He'll know how to get in touch with me if the Queen really needs me for something.
He groaned as he hauled himself to his feet.
I'm going to have to lose some weight, he said, half to himself.
Then he waddled to the door with that peculiarly spraddle-legged gait of the grossly obese.
He's in a charming humor today, Sparhawk noted.
He's got a lot on his mind just now.
Stregan shrugged. How well connected are you in the palace at Emsat, Stregan?
I have some contacts there. What do you need?
I'd like to put some stumbling blocks in the way of this accommodation between Avon and Count Garrick. Garrick's beginning to get a little too much influence in northern Eosia. Maybe you ought to get word to Melland in Asi as well. Garrick's making alliances in Pelosia and Thalesia already. It doesn't seem reasonable that he'd overlook Deira, and Deira's a little chaotic right now. Ask Melland to keep his eyes open.
This Garrick's really got you concerned, hasn't he?
There are some things going on in Lammerkand that I don't understand, Stregan, and I don't want Garrick to get too far ahead of me while I'm trying to sort them out.
That makes sense, I suppose.
End of side 1. To continue, turn the cassette over.